Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 314 featuring our great guest, Christian Debney, CEO at Stage 23 VFX in Australia. Nice guy. I really like Christian. Really cool guy. That's great. I love the fact now that we've actually done several podcasts in Australia. It makes just across the date line, but it's a lot of fun to do that and to talk to Christian and find out a little bit more about what he's doing and the cool stuff that he has done is really cool. Before I get into that, what were some of your impressions besides the fact that he's a cool Australian dude?
Very cool. I liked how Star Wars was his inspo at 7 years old, making Jabba the Hutt models, which is awesome. And then he went on to Clone Wars. So that's
cool. he made lightsabers, like the practical ones and everything. So he was a practical set guy and he made lightsabers. So that was really cool.
Yeah, that was awesome. And then you guys get into, well, one of the movies that, he was a second unit director on was Swinging Safari. So I think everyone needs to watch that now, especially after you guys talk about it. It sounds great.
I love that movie. And I'm actually considering doing that movie for my other podcast, Martini Giant, because it'd be really cool. It's a really kind of cool indie movie type movie, but and it's a comedy and it's just absolutely hilarious. So definitely watch it. Swinging Safari, and his work was fantastic in it. Plus, he had to direct kids, which is really, really hard. So I know that for sure.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
But he did some other cool stuff. What else did he do, Kristen?
Well, he actually has a movie coming out. He was a VFX soup on called Ascendant, which we will link the trailer. It'll be premiering actually right when this podcast comes out, and it comes out in Australia in April. And it's kind of like a horror movie. It looked really good. So we've gotten a little exclusive clip of it. Yeah,
we did. And what was really cool about that is they did the whole film, from home, as a lot of people have it to do these days. And they rendered everything using V-Ray Cloud. So it's like, it was just, they used their home computers and just made it happen. So it was kind of interesting how all of that worked and able to make that happen. But very easy. And like I said, Christian's a very resourceful person. And so managed to do a lot of cool stuff. So a lot of fun talking to Christian. Nice guy. I really love his stuff. And I absolutely love Swinging Safari. And we'll get into that a lot in the podcast. Okay, cool. We don't really have any big events that we want to announce just yet, but keep an eye out as we have in the next couple of weeks. We are going to have some really big announcements that are coming on for Chaos Group. A lot of stuff happening. So you keep an eye out for those things. You can, of course, follow all of the big announcements at chaosgroup.com. We do have a few things that are still going on, what's going on, Christian? Kristen. Why am I calling you Christian?
Sorry, my name is like everyone, Christine, Kristen. Okay, at chaosgroup.com, you can go to this to find this out. Sorry, we are extending the Utopia competition to March 1st. And actually, sorry, the competition link is buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com.
That's right. And if you guys remember the Building Utopia competition, in case you haven't heard, is using Vantage, which is our real-time ray tracing standalone application. And it's a really cool project where you basically we give you all the assets and say, here's a free copy of Vantage, and you can get to go ahead and do some really cool animations with it. And if you submit the project, you can win some really cool prizes from our partners at Lenovo, NVIDIA, Kitbash 3D, and of course, CG Architect. Again, that is buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. We have and Vantage is, of course, one of the announcements also that I mentioned is out. It is currently still free. If you want to try it out, we would love to hear your feedback on that. And we have a couple other cool products. What's come out recently, Kristen?
Yes. So V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D is out, and V-Ray 5 for Revit Beta is out as well.
Perfect. So V-Ray 5 C4D. This is again our brand new V-Ray for C4D. A lot of changes have happened since your last time. It's not your old V-Ray for C40. This is V-Ray 5, so it's got all the V-Ray 5 stuff, including the new frame buffer, light mix, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot of stuff is going in there. And then, of course, the same thing is true for Revit, with a lot of stuff happening there. And that is still in beta, so your feedback is very important for the beta products. If people want to know more about the podcast, Kristen, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you have any questions, of course, or ideas, labs@chaosgroup.com is where you can reach us via email. You can, of course, just reach us out on our social media platforms as well. But labs@chaosgroup.com is a really good platform to reach us out there. And we would, of course, love your feedback and your ratings on Apple Podcasts. So if you are on Apple Podcasts, make sure you give us a rating and a review. Always appreciated. And I think that's about it. All right. With that, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Christian Debney of Stage 23 VFX.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Now, Henry was adamant, like very excited about doing the interview with you. He's like, oh, you got to do a podcast with Christian. I was like, that sounds great. Sounds really cool.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, obviously, I think we need to learn a little bit about you and get a little bit of your back history, your origin story, as it may be.
Yeah.
And I know you started in practical effects. And I know that's one of the things that's interesting.
The first job I had, I did a degree in model making, basically.
Okay.
I'm kind of like, you know, a lot of people start off like, what film influenced you when you were growing up and all that? And obviously, along with millions and millions of others, mine was Star Wars.
Sure.
And so I think the story that my mum always tells is that I made a paper mache Jabba the Hutt when I was 7 years old, and a salacious crumb out of pipe cleaners and felt, and I took it to my school, and we did like a show and tell, a British version of a show and tell, I guess, and I said, when I grow up, I want to work for Star Wars. So that's how the story goes. So basically, I was always into art and creative sort of pursuits as a kid and as a teenager, and we made films on VHS cameras and had two video recorders, and we were editing, you know, the old-fashioned way before there was any of the software or computers around or anything. And then I ended up doing a degree in model making in Hertfordshire in England.
Okay.
And we graduated in 97. Uh-huh. And the same time that we were graduating, there was a new film happening at Leavesden Studios, and it was The Phantom Menace.
Oh, right, of course.
So I ended up sort of persuading them to give me a job, and found myself walking onto the sound stages and seeing George Lucas and R2 units and moisture evaporators, and ended up working on that and making lightsabers and guns. And so that was my first job.
That's pretty amazing. That's a pretty good first job. I mean, that must...
I kind of felt like my life had come full circle. Uh-huh. Although, as I realize now, it had only just begun. So,
right.
So, yeah, it was really, a good way to start things off, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So practical effects and model making was your influence. But you started doing this when you were seven, making a job at a hut out of
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was always some, and photography as well is something I'd always done. Mm-hmm. So I think those two things, and obviously, you know, we're here to discuss 3D predominantly, you know.
We're here to discuss everything and everything. So don't
filmmaking and all that sort of thing. So I've always looked at 3D. I've never been a coder.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't even think I have any qualifications in any sort of mathematics or anything. And I know you don't need to do that, but I've always looked at psychologically, I've always looked at 3D as though there's a table, there's a workbench, and there's practical lights, and there's practical cameras, and all that sort of thing, and just kind of treated it that way. Right. I did a lot of architectural model making professionally and things like that, which really helped. And obviously with photography, you know, you learn about exposures and depth of field and all that sort of stuff as well. So there's a whole tool set outside of 3D that I kind of built up over the years, and it came in very handy when I professionally started doing animation and visual effects, which was my first professional job doing that. Was I came over to Australia, which is where I still am, to work on Attack of the Clones. So they invited me, you know, said come over and do the same. So there I was making, I think I made about 200 lightsabers on Attack of the Clones.
Really?
I take my little box onto set. And
how do you make a lightsaber? Like if someone's going to make a lightsaber, what are the ingredients needed?
Well, the old fashioned way, you know, we're talking like 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I know that the new way is a lot different. They actually light up, I think, this time around.
Yeah.
But the old fashioned way was you make the originals out of, you know, probably the same way as they do now, but you steel lathes and all that sort of stuff, and you've got the nice polished original one. And then for the stunt props, we would then fiberglass mold that, put a big screw thread rod in, so it's kind of fastened to the plastic.
Yeah.
And then we just take metal, which I think at the time was called Derylium, and we'd spray that orange and shrink wrap that and then screw that on. And then we'd make about, you know, like I say, made about 200 of those. We'd wheel them onto set in this big box that we made and hand them out to the guys, and they'd fight with them and bend them and break them. And then we'd replace them. Beryllium was supposed to be an unbendable metal, but it didn't turn out that way. And I think it ended up, ILM probably had to paint out the bent rods and put in the straight ones, so they kind of doubled their workload, I think.
Wow.
So it's the old fashioned way was all post and fluorescent orange and green and that sort of thing. But I think
that was for tracking purposes. You'd make those colors for tracking.
Yeah, exactly. Got it. And then but now I think they light up. We did actually on Attack of the Clones, there were some close ups with Hayden and Christopher Lee where they actually did have lightsabers that lit up,
mm-hmm.
but they were kind of cabled. So I think they just use them for close-ups, but it gave a nice sort of GI effect, I guess, on the line.
That's how you
make a lightsaber. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
I've told that story a few times.
Yeah, that's. I'm sure you have. I mean, I'm sure people are like, I want a lightsaber. How do you make one? Well, that's just how you make it.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty awesome. So you came to Australia. So what year did you come to Australia?
January 2000.
Okay.
Yeah, that was when Attack of the Clones was. So I ended up working on that, and then ended up at Animalogic working on Farscape.
Nice.
And, which was a really nice TV show, and there was about 19 of us on the upper floor in Animalogic, and a really great bunch of guys. And we did, I think it was the second or third series. I was there for 18 months, and it kind of felt like a boot camp.
Okay.
We did 3D Studio Max and Digital Fusion was primarily what we used.
Got it.
And then it was kind of around that time people were starting to use GI softwares like Brazil,
uh-huh.
which came. And then V-Ray, of course. That was when I first started using V-Ray.
Right. So early days.
Oh, very early. Yeah. No, I've not used anything else since.
Right.
So I was there for 18 months, and then I left and made a short film at Fox Studios, which I wrote and directed, and did all the visual effects for as well. That was the reason why I moved into visual effects, because I was writing screenplays and things like this when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I was trying to work out how you would practically do these things, and then I had a little model-making company, and I bought myself a computer to do all the paperwork and all the admin and all this sort of stuff. And I went around to a friend's house, and he showed me this software on his new computer called Bryce. And that just changed my life.
Of course.
It was just like, you can make rocks float, you know? And it was just like, I was making rocks with rods on them that I was going to have to somehow paint out and things like this. So So yeah, Bryce changed my life, and I didn't look back. And I was, you know, playing with things like True Space and all this sort of stuff. And then 3D Studio Max was the first one I got my hands on, and
right.
And I've just pretty much stuck with that ever since.
Right. So you've always sort of had more of a like a generalist like idea. Yeah. Like I just need to get whatever I need to do to get things done. Right. So like.
Yeah, that's it. The one area that I kind of wish I looked into more was probably character animation.
Okay.
I mean, now you can use mocap and things, but I wish I was a bit more versed in that. But, you know, you can find great people out there that can help you do that.
Yeah, you're right. I think the generalists are very good at just big set, big building,
and
camera animation really good, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But character animation takes a different breed of person that's a little bit different.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have the patience for that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think you have to have some acting skills too.
Well, so, I think,
sometimes
I
don't have
that
either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I can tell. I can direct. I mean, I directed music video. Yeah, so to go back to the story. So I was at Animal Logic, did the short film, and that got into places like Toronto and Palm Springs and things like that. So, and then I went back to London and in about 2004, and I started directing music videos in London.
Right.
And did some quite successful ones and ran a couple of effects companies there. And the only way to make money really doing music videos was to direct them, but also have visual effects in them.
Right.
So you'd get the directing budget would also always be minimal. But then if you wrote a lovely bit of VFX, then you'd get all that money. So it kind of,
right.
You'd be able to survive being a music video director. That was kind of how I saw it. And it also, I tended to write treatments for music videos when a new plugin came out or something, a new piece of software. So, but, oh, right, that's cool. How can we write that into a music video? And then
right.
sort of experiment with it and be paid to experiment with it and to build up our, you know, our knowledge and skill sets. And then
it's true. Music videos really give you sort of an idea of things you can experiment with. There's a lot more freedom involved, right?
Yeah, they really do. I mean, I haven't directed a video for a long time, but certainly when I was doing it in sort of 2004 to 2011, it was a good time, and cameras were, you know, DSLRs were coming out, and things were easier to make and easier to film, and the budgets were going down. And there was quite a lot of opportunity there for us. So, I would say to anyone that was wanting to sort of direct, just start making promos, music promos. It's just the best way to do it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's really cool. So when you were doing these music videos, were you doing the visual effects by yourself, sort of like, or did you manage a small team, or?
It varied. Most of them, there would be two or three of us.
Okay.
And then sometimes we'd get crews up to sort of 10, 20.
Okay.
Depending on the scale and also obviously the budget. And then we'd also do, I had this little company there in Camden in London, and we'd also work with the other directors. So we'd come and we'd do animation for them as well. And we kind of became this this kind of go-to company that could do pretty decent stuff for a lot less than some of the places in Soho could do them.
Right.
Probably not quite to the quality, but you know, cheap and cheerful and just fun. And we were just a group of guys that were just obsessed with what we were doing.
Right.
And we just lived and breathed it, which I think you kind of have to be, certainly to start off with.
Okay.
So we had some good stuff going out back then. But
So what year about was this approximately?
That was about from 2005 to 2011.
Oh, okay, quite some time.
Yeah.
Quite some time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then I was a director of animation on the London Olympic opening ceremony.
Oh, nice.
Which was really interesting.
Yeah.
We used 3D Max and V-Ray for the stuff that I was working on.
Wow.
And working with Danny Boyle was fantastic. And so that was really great. And then I came to Australia to direct a film, which 7 years later was still in development. And So I've done a lot of concept art and a lot of concept work. And then in the meantime, I've set up an animation studio in Fox Studios. And we've done about 8-9 films in the last 2 years. And then most recently, we've just completed work on a film called Ascendant.
Okay.
Which is coming soon, very soon in cinemas in Australia. And that was a big job. That was about over 400 shots, photorealistic animation and all sorts of particle effects work. And very ambitious film by a new filmmaker called Ant Furlong. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And we did that over the lockdown and got to experience working remotely and sort of carrying on through all that. And we're pretty pleased with it.
400 shots is a lot for most companies. That's a lot.
It is. Yeah. I mean, originally it was about 50.
Yeah, of course.
and then I think I ended up doing about single-handedly did about 40 minutes of previs in about 6 or 7 weeks whilst they're doing the edit. Because we kind of quickly realized, you know, and quickly realized, and we did as well. I mean, we worked very closely together. He's a really, really great guy to work with, and throwing ideas back and forth and all this. It was really nice. And we realized that the 3D and the animation, the visual effects side of it were a big part of the story.
Okay.
They were a character in itself almost, even though it's an environment. I think there's a trailer actually coming out in the next couple of days. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so we'll,
maybe we'll be able to put that up with the podcast episode,
yeah,
which would be great.
Yeah. So, this is the thing. Being a generalist, you're kind of able, like you say, you can throw cameras around, and certainly with 3D Studio Max, I personally find it like I know it like the back of my hand, and I was just able to knock out all these previous shots. And we had the environment built. We had a couple of guys building the environments and things like that. So. But yeah, so we did scale up to about 400 shots, and a lot of work. And we had about 12 of us, I think, 2D and 3D.
Okay.
Yeah. My business partner, the company that I have now at Fox is Stage 23, we're called.
Okay.
And my business partner, Jonathan Herman, is very skilled in Flame. He's been doing Flame for about 20 years. He was supervising at Framestore in London. He's Australian, but he was over in London for about 10, 12 years. And he's very skilled at what he does in the 2D world, and I'm pretty good at what I do in the 3D world. So it's kind of a good mix.
Right.
Yeah. So we met on a film called Swinging Safari.
I love Swinging Safari.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it, yes.
Oh, yeah. Really? You're joking?
No, I'm not joking. You know where I
That's
saw
hilarious.
It is I saw I saw Swinging Safari on, I think it was an Air New Zealand flight. So I was on an Air New Zealand flight from L.A. to London, because there's actually a pretty cheap fare to go from L.A. to London, because they basically go New Zealand, L.A., London. So you can actually hop on as an extra to, you know, to make that little jump. And so I was just watching and I was like, Swinging Safari, I love the name of this film. And it was so funny, really, really funny.
That's made my day.
Yeah.
Not many people have seen it.
No, it's a great film. Yeah, it's really funny. The 70s and the way it's portrayed
is
really great. That's the one that has the big whale on the beach, right?
Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
And the sunken living room,
yes. Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah, because I was second unit director on it.
Really?
And yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And I did a lot of I directed the stunts and the kids and the animals.
And I also did
all the home movie stuff with the kids.
Yep.
And in fact, there's one scene talking about my early days as a filmmaker when I was a teenager. A lot of that stuff is based on what I was doing when I was a teenager myself. So we actually built watermelon heads and covered them in putty so they looked like heads, and we smashed them up so they looked like brains going in. So it was a really good opportunity to relive all that, but knowing that it was going to be in a proper movie.
Yeah.
So because Stephen Elliott is he's a very colourful, very vibrant, very encouraging director.
Yeah, and, I've always been, honestly speaking, I think I've always been a fan of Australian films because I think that there's something really fascinating about there's something very rough about Australian films that makes them feel like a modern Western in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, I think that's, I can relate to that. I think I know what you mean there. Yeah.
That's really awesome. I want to get back to your 3D, but I'm going to fan out a little bit on that because I'm a huge, I have another podcast I do called Martini Giant, where we talk a lot about filmmaking, about films that we love. And we talked a lot about Australian New Wave, like Wake and Fright. And
That's great.
Yeah.
Wake
and Fright. That's another one we saw that was like Bad Boy Bubby, which is like crazy.
Yes.
There's a lot of really interesting Australian films out there. And obviously Mad Max is a massive one. Yeah.
Well, the production designer of Fury Road was obviously not I think he might have even been the original, Colin Gibson.
Yeah.
He was production designer on Swinging Safari.
Oh, awesome.
He won the Academy Award for
Fury Road.
He's probably one of the funniest guys. And cleverest guys you'll ever meet.
I bet.
He's fantastic. It was great fun working with him.
That is so cool. That's so cool. Okay, but let's get back to the 12 people doing 400 shots.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In how much time, approximately?
Oh, what was it? About 7 or 8 months. 8 months.
Okay. So considering, you know, back when I first started in visual effects, you know, in the early 2000s, doing 400 shots was like a 2-year process and a couple hundred people, you know,
it felt like it.
And so that is it's kind of amazing that your people are able to do what they're able to do these days. And especially considering the fact you guys were doing this during a lockdown. So how was that experience of doing 400 shots during a lockdown for a movie, in that area?
Well, the advances that we had, I think, was when we set the company up, we wanted to have a lot of our employees working remotely anyway.
Got it.
We kind of felt that was a fresh way to run it. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, with the bigger companies, you know, we were doing smaller films at the time, and obviously, you get a Marvel film or something like that, then there's a whole different sort of legal system where that might not be possible, or as we've discovered, it's fine now because everybody's just been forced into working that way.
Yep.
So we did have that advantage that we were working remotely for quite a few of the guys. Some of them were up in Brisbane, some are, you know, scattered around Australia. But we have an office at Fox Studios, and so there was a core team there, mostly the 3D guys.
Yep.
And then when COVID hit, oh, my wife was also pregnant as well at the time throughout it, which added to the drama.
Yeah.
So everyone kind of scattered a bit across Sydney. I worked from home predominantly. My business partner, Jonathan, stayed at the office. He was determined to sort of not go down with the Titanic and stayed at the boat. So he kind of steered it from the headquarters, if you will. And then some of the guys stayed there as well. But obviously keeping within the guidelines of what we had to do legally.
Of course.
So we just seemed to get through it, you know, and the director and everybody was just really understanding. It was just something that's out of our control, you know.
Right.
And because it was such a collaborative, creative project as well, you know, we were moving things, deadlines, you know, things got extended and things like that, but we just managed to get through it. I don't really know how. I mean, Jonathan's probably the guy to ask more than me, but we just seem to steer our way through it, and everybody was just really enthusiastic, and the shots that we were doing were just coming out really well. We rendered it all. Yeah, I'd say 90% of it we rendered on the cloud, on the Chaos Cloud.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I've been in touch with those guys, Vladi and those guys about the cloud since it arrived.
Right.
When it was in beta, I've been doing a VR animated stereo film animation for the last couple of years, and that was the first thing I was doing on the cloud, and then I just kind of fell in love with how easy it was to use,
right.
And so I suggested it for the film, and we just used it, and it just seemed to work.
That's, you know, pretty
awesome.
It
had its teething problems and things like that, but they were working really closely with us as well,
right?
So we don't have a render farm, we just did everything on the cloud.
Nice.
Which helped, and then people could download stuff from wherever they were and things like that. A percentage of those 400 shots are 2D, and then matte paintings and
sure.
a mix and 2.5D
yep.
and all that sort of stuff. I think full photorealistic 3D shots is probably about 150, getting up for 200.
Okay. And mostly like environment work and background replacement and
yeah, it's all environment work. Most of our work was set in one environment.
Okay.
But a very, very large, big. I won't tell you what it is because you need to see the trailer.
We'll see the trailer.
Yeah, but it's a very big, complicated, highly detailed environment.
Okay.
And it's probably the large. I can't remember what the size of the max scene was, but it was probably the largest scene I've ever worked with.
Nice.
And, and it was all done. The guys that did texturing as well. I mean, I kind of did a rough version. I mean, gave it to some guys who did UDIM textures and PDRs
right.
and all that sort of stuff, and it does look it does look beautiful. I think.
Nice.
Yeah,
I'm really
proud of it actually. How it came out, and then there's a couple of other. We use Tiflow as well for a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah,
and for particles and things. I mean, that was the thing. I was about to move over to Houdini, just because I loved all the particles and. I can't get my head around thinking particles, and then Tiflow came out just as the film was taking off.
Yeah,
and so I kind of test drove some really big particle scenes using Tiflow.
Right,
and I love it. And I don't know whether you know much about it. But,
I do. I've actually been trying to get the author of Tiflow on this podcast, but unfortunately he's quite busy these days, so he's having
a sure he is. I mean, he releases, it's insane, the guy Tyson.
Yeah.
He releases like a new version every other week or something.
Yeah.
And I honestly have no idea how he's doing what he's doing.
Right.
I really don't. And And even just the community, like I'm part of the Facebook community,
right?
And it's just such a, it's the reason I go to Facebook basically, is to just see what everyone's doing and get notifications every time Tyson releases something new or someone's put a new video up on there with Tiflow. It's just really encouraging, and it's really good for 3D Studio Max users because you know, there was a struggle happening with that sort of stuff, and it
right.
feel like things like Houdini were just taking over, and even Cinema 4D and things like that. And I just feel that, I'm not in a hurry to go to those at the moment.
Right.
For me personally, it's enough.
Yep. Yeah, I definitely think that Tiflow, sort of enabled a lot of functionality that people were, anxious to have that they saw out of Houdini, but they now have ability
absolutely
in Max,
yeah.
which is great. And not to say that Houdini is not necessarily a good tool either. Houdini is a fantastic
tool
and can do a lot more. But the thing there's a certain itch that's being scratched by Tiflow.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, from my point of view, as I'm obviously a CEO of the company, but I also do the concept art.
Uh-huh.
And the original sort of working of the 3D. So I will do something in Tiflow or in 3D Studio Max, and it might get handed over to someone who is, you know, a genius with particles in Houdini.
Sure.
And then they take and run with it. You know, but I also have delivered stuff in the film that have just been done with Tiflow. So,
right.
You know, a lot of it is it's the who's using the tool rather than the tool itself, you know. So, I mean, for me, I've never left 3D Studio Max,
right?
Because and V-Ray. I mean, when Alex Roman brought out the third and the seventh, I was
yep.
just like, "Well, I just don't need to do anything else. I just need to know exactly how he's done this,
right?"
And I kind of spent about 4 or 5 years trying to get to that, you know.
Yeah. I think what's important of what Alex did, and I think, you know, as someone who worked with physical stuff and physical cameras and physical all that stuff, is what Alex did is he actually basically put in real world parameters into what he did.
Exactly.
And got something that looked photoreal. And the reason it looked photoreal because he was using parameters. And if you really look at a ray tracer, what it's supposed to do is supposed to mimic things. And if you start to deviate from that, and that took a long time for people in the CG world because they spent so much time not having pure ray tracing available to them. But I think Alex is like, no, it's like a real camera, so I'm going to treat it like a real camera. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, it looks like it was shot with a real camera. Well, that's what it was. So,
exactly. I think that's a really important thing that people couldn't really get their head around.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you do set your exposure correctly and all that sort of stuff, and also his materials, I mean, his scene files are available on CG Trader.
Yeah.
And you download his materials. I mean, I spent so many months trying to perfect the white plastic inside some of his the Milwaukee Architecture Museum without having the scene.
Right.
And then I downloaded it and looked at it. It's just a white material.
Yep.
With like a V-Ray dirt on it. It's just so simple.
Yeah.
And it's just all about photography. It's about understanding how photography works, and that's the trick to it, I think.
I think that's a really great, I think it's a really good perspective because, you know, especially, you know, to me, I've never met you until today. So it's kind of a hard thing, but it definitely sounds, there's a certain group of people who feel that they need to make things more complicated than they need to be
in order
to justify their position in a place or their price or whatever it is. Like, I know a lot, so therefore I made this really, 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 really complicated and no one else can do it because I know how to do it. And the truth is, if you're dealing with ray tracing, let the program deal with it and just concentrate on being an artist.
That's it. Yeah, that's true. And you know, I have directed on projects.
Right.
And I have employed animators.
Right.
People have, you know, animators can be a funny breed. I'm included in that, you know. And there is a certain prize and all this sort of, I have this skill set that no one else can touch and all this sort of thing. And I have, you know, and they haven't known that I am able to do 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So I can at some point think that's taking an awful long time. And then I can say, look, here you go. This is what I've done in 20 minutes. And you know, it works, it's good enough, you know. I think when I was at university doing my degree in model making, I came up with this concept. They used to have these Smirnoff adverts, which through a bottle you could see the world slightly differently,
right?
And I did this one where there was a row of robots, and one of them through the Smirnoff bottle, they're on a factory line just doing some metal work. So through the Smirnoff bottle, the robot was painting a beautiful picture or something. So I made these out of these robots sort of that big and photographed it and stuff. And I only made the side that we were shooting. I didn't make the front side of it because you didn't see that in the final image. And the lecturers didn't actually like that because I was doing a degree in model making.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, I didn't see the point in building that side because it's not for the final image. And I kind of put that to 3D. You know, it doesn't really matter what software you're using or how many pieces of software. You don't need Photoshop and ZBrush and all this and this and this to get an image that doesn't require that.
Right.
You just got to kind of think a bit harder. How can I do this in the simplest way possible to get the final image? You know, that's kind of been my philosophy around the whole thing, really.
Yeah, I was gonna, you know, since you brought it up, I was gonna bring it up and circle back. You mentioned, you know, obviously model making was the thing that you worked on, or you were educated in, but you did obviously work on in practical stuff and films. But you said you also did architectural modeling as well.
Mm.
So because we, you know, for at Chaos Group and in the podcast, we have people in the visual effects world and out of the architecture world. I mean, what are some of the differences that you see? You obviously said I don't need to build the backside of that because it's not going to be seen from camera. But from the architecture point of view, how different is that?
Well, I think the biggest thing with architectural model making is there's no undo button.
Right.
You know, I mean, I remember we built this, I was at this this guy must have been sort of early 70s, really beautiful craftsman in terms of making architectural models. I was in his studio and we'd spent about a month making this housing estate. It was a really nice looking piece of work, but he wanted to sort of spray brush on the grass and around it just to make it sort of look a bit dirty and a bit worn in and stuff. But he just couldn't bring himself to do it. And he was frightened of like wrecking the whole thing. And I just grabbed it and went, right, I'll do it, and just did it. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, I can't undo this if it's wrong, you know. But it ended up being okay, and it was fine, and the panic was over, and it was like it was done. And so, yeah, and I think that's the biggest contrast is I found is with practical effects is yeah, once you've done it, if you cut that slightly wrong or... And also getting measurements, I wasn't very good at sort of getting very precise measurements, whereas with a computer, it kind of does that for you. But right. cutting little windows, and you can't clone things and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
You know, it did become a bit monotonous. I worked at one of the jobs I had after the Phantom Menace was at Legoland, making things out of Lego.
Yeah.
And I worked on the California Legoland, and I spent about 2 months making a skyscraper, which must have been about the size of a house,
right,
or something like that, and just doing real size pieces of Lego.
Yeah.
And it's great fun when you start the job, the first few weeks, and then you just realize that you're making the Empire State Building out of Lego. And it's just, it kind of gets a bit monotonous. Whereas, you know, you could just do it in Tiflo, couldn't you, now?
Yeah, so, bloop.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it was the monotony of architectural model making.
Right.
But then there is that satisfaction from actually being able to touch it and feel it and,
right.
and understanding materials and all that sort of thing. Yeah. And that passes through, you know, your understanding of I think, on Star Wars, we were painting things to look like wood and things like that. So
yep.
you get a good skill at that, and then you can transfer that into 3D as well, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's really, really interesting. Okay, so you mentioned it. You obviously, you've been involved on set, you've been directing as well, and you've been writing scripts and, have ambitions as a filmmaker. How do you feel that, you know, your knowledge base that you've developed over time, including obviously practical effects, camera work, and 3D work, how is that going to influence, you know, some of the things, that decisions and stories that you make in filmmaking?
I mean, all of it, I have a very... Quite, you know, I'm 47 now, so mm-hmm. I've been doing this since I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a pretty good skill set, I feel, you know. And we've been in development on this science fiction film for 7 years, and we've worked with some fantastic writers. We're getting it nailed this year. I've worked with currently working with Jim Hart, who wrote Contact,
and
Nicola Thoris, who was a co-writer on Fury Road. Spent a stint with us working on it. And,
nice.
You know, so these things, I mean, Contact, Jim would say, took Carl Sagan and Jim obviously came on as one of the main writers for it. It took them 12 years to make.
Yeah.
So these things, I think patience is probably the biggest thing that I've acquired over the year.
Uh-huh.
And, but I have a knowledge now with the skill set that I kind of know how things practically and technically can be done, and
sure.
the best way to do them and the simplest way to do them. And just understanding the pipeline of not just a post-production set, but from script writing to shooting to rehearsals to, you know, to all that sort of stuff, down to edit and all that sort of thing. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, I'm attached to 2 films this year as a director, and I'm also directing a documentary feature this year as well, about a friend of mine who's just run a marathon in every country in the world.
Wow.
So that's, I mean, that's a different kind of format. There's a bit of motion graphics and a bit of 3D in it, but that is because he went around and shot the whole thing himself as well. I met him in Nepal and shot with him there, but that's going to be a process of understanding editing,
right?
More so than the other side of filmmaking, you know.
Yep.
So that's a challenge in itself because I'm using someone else's footage to kind of
an abundance of footage too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He shot 400,000 stills and 22,000 clips of video in various formats. And he spent 2 years, 196 countries, set the world record for being the first person to do that. And he shot the whole thing himself, mostly. And so I'm constructing an idea based on someone else's footage, and he's sort of given me free rein to do that. Whereas if you were directing a film that you'd written, you'd kind of know everything. You know, you'd know when you write a screenplay, you kind of feel that you know where your edit points are and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So so I kind of feel ready. You know, things do take a bit longer than I anticipated. I keep telling myself that Ridley Scott was 40 before he directed his first film. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's never too late.
No, yeah. Tim Miller was almost 50 when he directed his first film. So, that's definitely, I don't think it's a thing. The thing is, Ridley Scott is an example, and Tim Miller is an example too. I mean, yes, they were later in age when they directed their first film, but they came into it with an enormous amount of skills that formed the person that they became. So it's like,
absolutely,
and then now they're ready to do it. And it feels to me like you're going through a similar journey as they did. You know?
Yeah. No, in different ways. I mean, Ridley had done about 1,000 commercials, I think, before he shot his first film.
Right.
And he was obviously a really talented artist, and still is, and storyboards himself and things like that. And so I do feel that, there is this definite skill set. You know, I used to pre-vis all my music videos and things like that, even just as an exercise, just to do it. There's definitely, I will know when it happens and when we're on set, and when we're finishing the film, and when we have the first screening and things, and I'll know exactly which aspect of my 20 years and 25 years in the industry, where they worked and where they fitted into place and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to be quite exciting to sort of, I can do this. I can do that bit.
Right.
I know how to do this now because... Yeah, and then once you do one, you can then go and do another one.
Do you feel that, another example or a person that I keep thinking about is someone like Neil Blomkamp. When he looked at District 9, and obviously he came from the CG world and he understood that. He made a lot of decisions and choices in the way that he was going to, the story in the actual script that enabled more efficient things in the CG world because of his knowledge.
Absolutely.
Right? And do you think that that's going to be the same case for your ideas and the way that you think, because you're like, I have an idea of how we could do this, or?
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I was a big fan of it. I remember Tetraval came out, and the first thing I did was, how do you do that? Right, and I built this probably a crappier version of his robot and had it walking around our office in 3D and stuff.
Right.
And that was just, he was again, another Alex Roman that was just really sort of just doing stuff that other people were thinking about doing and close to doing, but just didn't actually execute it as well as they did,
Right.
It becomes second nature. It's about problem solving, isn't it? And manipulating things the way that you feel that they need to be to make things work, to make films work.
Right.
And look at Jaws as an example. The shark was intended to be in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then it didn't work. It sank and all this sort of stuff. So Spielberg was like, it's not in the movie. The idea of it, the threat of it is in the movie.
Right.
And then it featured a bit towards the end of the film. But it's the failure of things that can make things work in far better ways than you thought originally,
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Because I think that a lot of times people, especially if you have a limited budget and something fails, then you have to think of creatively of an alternative. And if there's an unlimited budget or a big budget, it just becomes a more expensive exercise and it never has the opportunity to become a different solution,
Yeah, I think so. And often with 3D, everybody wants to put in the bells and whistles and all this sort of stuff. But again, even just my knowledge of filmmaking and filmmakers and their approaches, another example is Psycho. Not once does the knife go into the flesh.
Right.
But in between the edits, it does in your head, and, yep. and that's and you feel it even though it's not there, you know. Right. And I think that 3D has that approach. I mean, I'm working on a VR project of mine, and I've been working out how to do a car crash in 3D, and then I thought, well, why not just do the car spinning towards the victim, and then you go to black and you just do the sound.
Right.
And I tried it, and I was like, it's just so much better.
Yeah.
You know? And absolutely. And then you show the aftermath.
Right.
You know, and the audience can spend what would take me a month to do as a successful 3D shot.
Yeah.
In a moment.
Yeah.
You know, and I think things like that is where I have you know, a skill set that I can really look to.
Absolutely. Know? I did a you know, speaking of short of car crashes, I did a short film where we were doing a car crash, and we're doing it all practically, but it was basically the car, and the driver in the car, and we're going like this, and then we cut to a shot where we actually had the bumper of the car up against a telephone pole, just close,
right,
and then we slowly backed up the car like this,
yeah,
and then we just. Yeah. You know, in the edit, we played it in reverse and sped it up.
Yeah,
that's and it. Then yeah, we just it. A bunch of sound.
Yeah,
and then us moving. We did the same thing where we were going like this, and we just went bam. So it looked like we hit the dashboard, and it looks like we spent $50,000 on a car crash.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and was that's done exactly for like it. Nothing. It was all done in the edit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly it. I mean, even in 3D, you know, like with Independence Day, for example. Another example is. The explosions through the city, they rotate the architectural models so that they use gravity to be the fire force, you know. And,
right.
And you can do that in 3D, you know. If you're not getting the settings that you want using real-world rotations and scales, you can cheat in 3D in the same way that I would if I was on a practical set.
Sure.
And then rotate it around and all that sort of thing. So it is, it's just thinking outside the box, I think. It just makes things work a lot better sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this is really exciting. I know we're kind of getting close to the end, but I just wanted to ask a couple more questions. Okay, say first, remind us the name of the film that's coming out so people can look at the trailer.
Oh, yeah. It's called Ascendant.
Ascendant. Okay, great. And it's a sci-fi film, I'm assuming, of some sort?
It's a psychological thriller kind of film. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I won't give anything away, but... Okay. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. Yeah,
okay.
It is.
And it's coming out in theaters in Australia. Will it be out on streaming at some point too, or you don't know?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're literally sort of getting all that done now, and it's coming soon in theaters in Australia first, and then, it will be here imminently.
All right. And then can you mention you said you were working on a script for a movie that's been in development for about 7 years. Can you mention what that is a little bit? Or
I could. I won't give you the name because I'm quite proud of the name. I think you just went.
But the
film is it's about consciousness. It's about human consciousness and the relation to the construct of the universe.
Okay.
It's not sort of AI. It's kind of, it's about human consciousness. I've worked with, I had people like Stuart Hameroff who worked with Sir Roger Penrose who got some pretty interesting philosophies on what consciousness is.
Right.
And how sound and vibration can affect consciousness and all this sort of stuff. So, it's quite a complex idea, which is probably why it's taken so long.
Right.
So, trying to make tell a complex story in a very simple way, I think, has been the hardest thing to achieve. But we're getting there.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. That's really cool. And you got a couple other projects that you got in the works as well.
Yeah, there's a horror movie as well called Encircled, which should be shooting this year.
Okay.
And then the VR film. Currently, it's called Time Travel Zero, which is a really exciting thing. I know Chris Milk, who's a bit of a pioneer with VR.
Yeah,
he's got a company called Within, I've known Chris for quite a long time when I was directing videos, and Jamie Hilton, who's a well-established film producer here,
right,
and a long-term friend of mine as well. They've been waiting patiently for me to complete this VR film, and And it's all 3D Max, V-Ray, GI, 360 stereo.
Okay.
So it kind of, a lot of the films I'd seen are sort of, you know, like, not that I'm dismissing any of them or the software used, but Unreal Engine, so it doesn't have that sort of realistic look to it. So I'm trying to sort of push that boundary, treating it as though I'm making like an IMAX movie, but in animation, and it's based on a time traveling astronaut.
Okay.
So that's coming along this year as well.
Awesome.
So,
yeah.
And then there's also my company. We have two pretty big films this year, and then so 2021 is shaping up to be a pretty busy year already.
Yeah, and I'm assuming you mentioned your wife was pregnant during the pandemic. Assuming
yes,
is she no longer pregnant, or do you guys have a child?
We have a beautiful little baby girl. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful! Well, congratulations! Yeah. Congratulations!
Yeah, thanks.
That's tough. I know a lot of people who had kids during the pandemic. It's got to be a little bit scary, obviously, to have that. Yeah.
It was, yeah. There were moments, certainly the first part of it, when everyone's sort of binge buying toilet rolls and supermarkets are emptying out and panic's right, being spread around. It's it was a bit uncertain. Mm-hmm. You know, how is this going to pan out?
Sure.
Am I even going to be allowed to be there at the birth and all this sort of stuff? And
right.
And obviously, the hardest thing for us is that our family are all in England, and none of them have met her. You know, it's all been over Zoom calls and video calls and things, and
right,
and we just like them all to be able to come over, and we're not sure when that's going to happen yet.
Yeah,
and obviously, you know, with the support network and all that sort of stuff, and but I've been working at home predominantly at the moment, and back at Fox soon next month, and then we'll see how things go from there.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. Well, very excited, for your films, and, you know, please, when, you know, Kristen will send you an email, if you can send us any links or anything that happens,
yeah,
a trailer out, let us know, and we'll put that in the show notes
so
people can check that out. And obviously, you know, it's really exciting that you guys are using our cloud solution for the project, which is great. We're happy to see that being used on big projects like that. And Henry will be writing that. So there's probably going to be a blog post about that project as well.
So it'd be great to do a proper post for you guys and put some images in there and all that sort of thing.
Well, thank you so much, Christian. I really appreciate you doing this with us, and I know my video keeps going up, but hopefully it will come back.
I'm really pleased you saw Swinging Safari as well. That's made my day.
I know. I love that film. That film was lot of fun.
A lot of fun to make. I think it was a lot of fun, maybe too much fun to make. But it was good.
Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Christian.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Chris.